The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 5, our series on health professions education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined in person by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaia. We have the pleasure today of sitting down at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine, AMWI 25, where we get to discuss adjusting crucial conversations based on personality and psychological safety with our guests. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Of course, Molly. We're the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. And we have an amazing conversation today on kind of the combination of psychological safety, personality awareness, and how we can really harness both of those when we have crucial conversation. And this is with our guests tonight, Ashley Johnson, CTAGME, Julie Byington, CTAGME, and Drs. Samatha Ankireddy and Laura Thompson.
Amazing. And our guests are Ashley Johnson, CTAGME, is the program coordinator for the White River Health in Batesville, Arkansas, with 5 years of experience in the internal medicine residency. And Julie Byington, CTAGME, is a GME professional with 12 years of experience in residency and fellowship administration at the Washington University in St. Louis, internal medicine residency, and she also serves as the administrative lead for the Department of Medicine Vice Chair of Education.
And our amazing chief resident guests, we have Dr. Samatha Ankireddy, who's an internal medicine chief resident at Penn State Health Milton Hershey Medical Center, graduated from University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Medicine in 2021, and completed her internal medicine residency at Penn State Health in 2024. She will soon start her fellowship in hematology oncology at the Cleveland Clinic. And Dr. Laura Thompson is an internal medicine chief resident at Penn State Milton Hershey Medical Center. She graduated from the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University in 2021 and completed internal medicine residency at Penn State Health in 2024. And she will soon start her fellowship in pulmonary critical care at Rutgers New Jersey Medical Center.
And we are excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. A quick reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all of our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content and haven't yet joined, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource.
So without further ado, let's get to it.
Well, we have a big group today. We're very excited to sit down with all of you here at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine and be able to discuss communication and ways to improve our communication styles. Mm-hmm. We'll start with you, Dr. Samatha Ankireddy and Dr. Laura Thompson. Are you okay if we call you Samatha and Laura today?
Sure, of course.
Samatha. Yeah, that works.
Amazing. And Samatha, we'll start with you. Do you mind giving our listeners just kind of a quick one-liner to describe who you are and maybe include something from outside of medicine?
Of course. Chief resident, aspiring hemonc physician, daughter, big sister,
explorer, and a chocolate lover.
Do you have a favorite chocolate?
I do. My favorite one right now is Ferrero Rocher's. Have you had them before?
Of course.
Aren't they the best?
Yes. I don't want to kind of share too much of my immigrant past, but I feel like all immigrants somewhere in their deep hearts are like, Ferrero Rocher is the best chocolate ever. And I feel like it's, I don't know, just something about that nut covered chocolate goodness.
It's the best. I could have one at any time of the day.
Yes. I hear that. And Laura, do you want to share a one-liner about yourself with maybe something outside of medicine as well?
Yeah. So I would describe myself as a first-generation doctor, baseball lover, history enthusiast, and Disney trivia nerd. Weirdly good at Disney factoids.
Like Disney theme parks, Disney movies?
Disney movies.
Okay.
All right. We had a theme park lover yesterday.
So. Yeah.
And specifically Disney theme park. Mm. So... you know, there's some connections to be made. I will think of a Disney question to ask you somewhere. We'll bake that into the case. And Julie Bington and Ashley Johnson, thank you both. C-Tag Me, amazing administrators here with us today. Julie, do you mind if we call you Julie for this recording?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Ashley, do you mind if we call you Ashley?
Of course.
Thank you. Well, would you all also be able to share a one-liner about yourselves, including something outside of the professional world?
Sure. I consider myself a very passionate GME program administrator with 12 years of experience in both internal medicine and hematology oncology. And then outside of work, I'm a wife and a mom of two. I'm an avid crocheter and I'm a Girl Scout troop leader.
Wow, that seems like a lot.
It's not a little.
Yeah, exactly. Does that mean that you're also involved in the cookie sales?
Absolutely. Amazing. I'm a cookie mom just coming fresh off of 4 cookie booths in March and February.
Wow. Are you allowed to like share your favorite cookie? Is that like possible?
Oh, absolutely. As my daughter would say, all of them. I would narrow it down to probably the Samoas.
Samoas. Wow, Julie. Okay. Me too. Basic as well over here. Yeah. And Ashley, do you want to share a one-liner as well about yourself? The award-winning Ashley, yeah. I should say.
But thank you very much. So I'm the program coordinator for White River Health in Batesville, Arkansas. So a small community hospital. I've been the program coordinator for going on 5 years now. And then outside of my job, me and my husband have a small hobby farm just on our property. And so we have lots of fur babies. We have 7 dogs, multiple cats, and then rabbits, goats, chickens, ducks, geese, guineas, turkeys.
Wow. There's so many animals there.
too many.
Do you name them all?
We tried, mm-hmm. And now at this point, I don't know who's who. So
I guess this is kind of like children. Maybe you're not allowed to have a favorite, but do you have a favorite, Ashley?
Oh, do I have a favorite? I do love my dogs a lot. Oh. All 7 of them.
Also, but not like one within the 7.
Well, so Shiloh, he's our little beagle. He's my buddy. I love my Shiloh.
Like after the book, Shiloh?
The movie.
Or is the movie?
Yeah. It was supposed to be my husband's dog, but he loves me a little bit more. But don't tell my husband.
That's amazing.
We'll make sure he doesn't listen.
Yeah.
Well, Ashley, how's it been here at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine? What's your experience been like at the conference this week? And do you have anything that really surprised you or any take-homes that you feel like you want to pass on to others?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this week has been absolutely amazing. This is my 4th year coming to the conference, and it's something I look forward to each year. It's how I actually connected with my mentor, Julie. So she is my mentor. We meet monthly through Zoom, and we get to connect in person here. This conference is absolutely wonderful for, you know, all areas of GME. I feel like you get information and ideas that you can easily take back to your own programs and institutions. And it's just a wonderful conference to come to.
I think those connections are so important and so valuable. And yeah, I would definitely agree that just getting to meet different people and learn from best practices at other places is so huge. Julie, what about you?
This has been a particularly busy APTIM conference for me. I believe this is my either 5th or 6th. I'm starting to lose count. But I was the chair of the Program Administrators Advisory Council this year. So I've been very busy presenting myself. I delivered 3 presentations plus closed the conference for our administrators. So for me, I haven't been able to attend a lot of sessions, but I was amazed to be able to come back, and I've made so many amazing colleagues and what I would call friends. I mean, it's just, they are so far beyond colleagues at this point. And so it's like a homecoming each year that I come back. I'm so excited to look forward and see these people and continue to meet more. So it's been really amazing to, again, like we were just talking about, getting those connections, both new and old.
I love that, Julie. I feel like it's like not many people are like a reunion I want to come back to, you know, or like a homecoming necessarily. But I love that AIM Week has, you know, been that for you. And you're clearly a connector and kind of a person who makes this happen. So thank you for that. Well, Samatha, do you mind sharing for you kind of how your experience at AIM Week has been as a chief and maybe what surprised you, what's been a take-home point?
Of course. It's really been great being here this time around. Last year was my first time here at APTM. And at that time, you know, we were in the audience, we were nervous, we were meeting so many other rising chiefs and just getting ready to start our new role. This year, it's kind of the opposite, you know. We're presenting a workshop, which we did yesterday. Ooh. It's great being on this side and being able to share our experiences that we've had this past year. And honestly, like my co-chiefs and I, Laura, Dr. Fareed Zainuddin, and Dr. Priya Ramachandra, we've like worked a lot on this workshop and it means a lot to us. So it's just really nice to see everything happening and meeting other people.
Laura, what about you? How has AIM Week been for you?
Yeah, I think I would echo a lot of what Samatha said. You know, last time we were here was my first time at this conference as well. I was stunned at how big it was and just like so enthusiastic and excited about the upcoming year and soaking everything in. This year, I think it was really cool to be on the presenter side and then also still attend the GME track and learn more about academic medicine, you know, from behind the scenes in a way that the chief resident track sort of doesn't prepare you for. And it was really great to see my co-chiefs just like have such a fun time presenting and see the audience respond to them and just really thrive. So it was really a great opportunity.
Julie and Ashley, you guys presented a workshop titled Navigating the Jungle of Personalities, Leveraging Personality Awareness for Enhanced Communication. Could you share what made you passionate about this area and how you decided to workshop this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, a big part of it goes back to where I work at. We are a small community hospital. Right now, our residency program is 30 residents. And Batesville is a population of about 11,000. So we're a pretty small area. And for Batesville, it's where I was born and raised. It's my home. I love it. But there's a lot of, you know, the farmers, people, and I'm trying not to do it on this podcast. My southern slang will come out.
Please bring it out. You are among southern friends.
Like y'all, you all may mention.
Yes, please.
And so now that we have the GME at the hospital and we're bringing in people from different cultures and different backgrounds, I felt it's very important, not only for myself, but for also our residents. You know, this type of a session helps them interact with the patient population and me interact with them. And so I can respect their backgrounds as well.
Yeah. And then from my end of it, I was really coming at a lens of having gone through multiple program director changes, switching from one specialty to another and having to relearn teams. And each time you do that, it takes a little while to get that rhythm down with a new person and really work to understand how that dynamic is going to play out. And what we noticed when discussing it was that in our space in the program administrator side, we had over the last several years had a lot of workshops specifically speaking to the program director and program administrator role and how to navigate those relationships. But we weren't seeing a whole lot of more broad communication. And we thought it was important to sort of, you know, just give those, you know, really basic communication skills, like because it is a soft skill that we don't get taught, and it really breaks down when, you know, people aren't, you know, necessarily naturally getting this. So we thought it would be a great topic to bring forward. And honestly, we were shocked to walk into a standing room only workshop room for this.
As somebody who was there and was standing, it was quite amazing and quite worth it. And I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah. At one point, I actually stopped. It was like before it got started, but the room was already packed. I stopped and looked at the app to make sure I was at the right location.
Yeah. We're right.
Like, is this our room?
Like, is this really our room? We seriously arrived like 25 minutes early to a half-filled room. It was the middle of a break time with coffee and beverages, and we really thought we were not in the right place.
Yeah, it was exciting.
That's really awesome to hear. Now we wish we could have been at that workshop. Similarly, Laura and I thought we'd be like so prepared. We printed like 120 copies of each handout, and we walk in and like we're running out of sheets of handouts. We're like, oh no, we're so sorry.
Yes.
And that's actually an amazing experience. So I should say, Samantha and Laura, y'all presented on Crucial Conversations, the one where the chief resident mediates conflict with the hierarchy or within the hierarchy. What got y'all interested in this? And it sounds like ready to print up 100 plus worksheets of and the handouts.
Yeah, so I think, you know, being a chief resident is such a unique experience. You're in a middle management position. It's like your first sort of real job after residency for a lot of people. You know, many people who become chief residents haven't had careers before they went into medicine, and navigating a really convoluted academic system, in our case, from, you know, Penn State Health, and also navigating those interpersonal relationships we already had with our residents. So it was really important to us that we were as objective and fair as possible, and really brought a, you know, a sense of fairness and equity to our role. And so, you know, that's really kind of where the interest started.
And I agree. I think it's totally a topic that we're very passionate about. And also, in complete honesty, it's something that we struggled with at the beginning of our chief year as well, right? We have so many conversations with different people, including our program director, everyone on leadership, residents, nursing staff, and really trying to identify how we communicate and how the best way to effectively have clear communication was something that we had to develop as well. And so really, like, just coming back to this conference and trying to provide all these rising chiefs who are so excited just a good set of skills to, like, start their year off strong was our main goal. And I think we've really had a lot of fun and excitement doing that.
Yeah, and I think, too, it was also really interesting because we have four chief residents at our programs and we're all really different. And so having to navigate being one office and being United Front, and we all had very different communication styles. You know, I'm a very, like, direct, big personality type of person. Samantha, you know, I think is pretty jovial and friendly. Priya is very quiet, but she observes everything. And then Fareed is pretty go with the flow. And so really meshing those personalities and figuring out how we're going to have conversations so that no matter who's in the room, we're sort of representing everybody's interest.
I honestly feel like that couldn't be a better setup, given that, you know, Ashley and Julie presented about personality awareness and y'all are talking about how do we, you know, kind of integrate those personalities and work well. So I think we are set up for success for this episode.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, both of you were targeting specific audiences, but I think this topic is so much broader and I'm really excited that we can bring it to a broader audience. And selfishly for Erin and myself, you know, these are skills that we're still working on too. And even though we're faculty many years in, we're still middle managers too, and it's not going to go away. So I think these skills are so valuable.
Yeah, 100%. I was going to say something when you said, like, this is an area of growth. I think Molly and I, you know, these topics are chosen for a reason. Yes. for these episodes. And they might be because some of them are areas of growth for us too, an improvement that we think, you know, really crosses health professions, crosses roles, crosses disciplines, really kind of everyone can get practical tips from y'all. So.
And we're really excited to hear what Julie and Ashley have to share and their discussion, and I'm sure we'll grow from it in the next hour or so.
Yeah, well, let's get started with the case from our fictional hospital, Cashlak Memorial. We have Kate, who's a supervisor of a large academic health professions training program. Kate has received comments about one of the program's faculty educators consistently not addressing trainee questions during their didactics. The most recent session included a lecture running overtime and the teacher noting that they will get to everyone's questions at the end, although they never did and ran 5 minutes over to finish their content. Kate comes to you to prepare to have this crucial conversation with the faculty later today. Laura and Samantha, if Kate came to you to ask for guidance on the keys to success for mediating conflict, where would you start?
Yeah, so I think, you know, from our presentation, the most important thing that you can do is set yourself up for success. Really focus on what the goal of the conversation is so that you're prepared when emotions flare. You know, this faculty member may not receive your feedback well, or you may find yourself getting uncomfortable. Really being able to focus back on that goal and having it be something, you know, that's tangible that you're deliberate about. Sticking to the facts and being direct, and that allows you to keep an open dialogue. And if you get derailed, again, really come back to that mutual purpose. This faculty member went into medical education for a reason. They likely have a passion for it. You know, they probably want to be a good educator and, you know, would be disappointed to learn that they're not coming across that way. So, you know, really focus on what you guys have in common and what the common goal is.
Totally. And I think one thing that we loved about y'all's presentation, your slides, is also kind of the resources that you shared. And one of the things I, saw coming through, not just from the title, but also kind of referenced, is the Crucial Conversation, that book, and kind of the approaches there. Would love to hear from y'all about kind of the frameworks and maybe specifically the first step around kind of the pilot.
Yeah. So, when making this presentation, it was really important to us to make it applicable to Chief Year. And, one of the things that we as a foursome were really excited about was the TV show Friends. It was kind of just the theme for our recruitment video with faculty. So we just kind of ran with it when developing this presentation. So we named the first part of the talk the pilot, kind of like the pilot episode, and it's our interpretation of Crucial Conversations, and it's really about laying a foundation for productive dialogue. So there are things that are going to kill a conversation right out of the gate before it ever starts. Number one, discussing the wrong problem. Number two, not understanding your own thoughts and feelings. And then number three, not addressing your own biases and assumptions before you start the conversation. A lot of us get tempted to sugarcoat things. We're uncomfortable giving negative feedback or disappointing somebody. And that ends up leading to a misunderstanding on the part of the recipient because they walk away with a very different interpretation than what you were trying to convey. So in Kate's case, she's trying to address a pattern of behavior with this faculty member. Seems like consistently this educator's lectures have not really resonated with the residents. But she might be tempted to say, hey, we got some feedback in our most recent lecture. And that would be an example where there could be a miscommunication right off the bat. So focusing in on the fact that this is a pattern as an issue. And then Kate should also do some pre-work for herself. Think about her own thoughts and feelings and address her own biases. Like, is this faculty member a friend of hers? And is that going to make her more likely to sort of downplay things and soften the blow? Or perhaps they have a more adversarial relationship, like clinically they give a lot of pushback on a consult, for example, and so she's expecting to meet a ton of resistance and sort of goes into the conversation with her danders up. The other person's going to pick up on that, and really it's going to kill your conversation before it ever starts.
I think it's also really important to stress to really identify how one person responds to conflict, right? Like, we've kind of identified three different buckets. The first bucket is Kate may want to completely avoid the conversation and hope that it just magically disappears. Another bucket is Kate may try to have the conversation, but unfortunately does not go well. And the third bucket, which is like our goal for all conversations, is that Kate has the conversation and is able to successfully convey what she wants to and come up with a mutually agreed upon plan.
And we'll talk about all the things I think that go into Kate's, own personality and approaches in a second. But wondering kind of when you all think about the other parts of kind of the Friends component of this, do you feel like one is the most important? Maybe it is the pilot. But one thing that for y'all just really resonates kind of as this is really when going into a crucial conversation, like we cannot miss this step.
Yeah, I think, for me personally, my opinion is honing in on your objective, because if you go into the conversation with the wrong topic, then it's not going to go anywhere. So in that sense, it's, the most important to me because it's the first. Like I mentioned, if Kate starts with, residents gave feedback on your most recent lecture that there was too much content, not enough audience participation, you didn't answer our questions, that faculty member is going to leave thinking they need to revise that one lecture as opposed to reassess their approach to resident education, which is Kate's ultimate goal. But that being said, it's really easy to allow our assumptions to sort of derail from our objectives. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about this scenario is, the educator is running overtime, and it would be really easy for Kate to assume that that's because the lecturer has poor time management skills or was trying to deliver too much content. But one of the things she may not have considered, something that we faced as chief residents is residents are very busy, and a lot of times they run late to conference. And so maybe this educator was planning on a 60-minute session and was only given 45 minutes because they had to start late, and that's why they ran over. But it's very easy to just assume that, the issue with the timing was all the lecturer's fault.
I would agree with Laura. I really think the preparation before you even have the conversation is one of the most crucial parts, right? This is where you kind of set up the scene, you define your objectives, and you go into the meeting with a clear purpose. And so for us this past year, any meeting that we've had that's high stakes, we really put some time into creating an outline prior to even having the conversation. And I think, like, fair to say, like, it's really worked for us and helped us out. Yeah. We usually, like, bounce ideas off of each other. We're like, hey, I'm having a meeting with nursing staff. Can you look at my outline and see if we're on the same page?
One thing I'm realizing, and I know, Molly, we're about to go to the next question, but one thing that's coming up for me and what y'all are saying is, like, how do we stay at the bottom rung of the ladder of inference, right? Because if we sit there and, like, you know, make those assumptions that you were just mentioning, Laura, I feel like you just get to a place where you're like, well, this person just clearly doesn't understand how important this thing is, or like how important, you know, whatever is, and they're just deciding. And to kind of like go back and see, like, what is the actual observable data? What is the reality? I think is really important for all of us as educators and in all and everything that we do. PSA over.
So I really appreciate how you guys focused on the pre-planning, and I think that's so key to really consolidate your message, make sure you're getting across the right information, reflect on your own feelings and thoughts coming into it, and also keep an open mind about where the other person might be coming from. When you actually get into the conversation with the person, how do you structure that meeting or the act to ensure that it goes as smoothly as possible?
That's a really good question. I think what's helped for us is always having a meeting outline prior to even having the meeting. So for example, in Kate's special circumstance, her meeting structure might follow. First, she's going to want to start the meeting and create a safe environment for both herself and the faculty educator. She wants to make sure that she's going to set aside time to state the objectives that she has in mind, but also remembering that the faculty educator might also want to share a few goals that he has in mind as well. It's important to find mutual purpose and always create psychological safety. And by that, what I really mean is creating a safe and comfortable environment for both Kate and the faculty educator, so they both feel comfortable sharing their opinions without worrying about any negative repercussions. And I think that's really important. And coming back to the fact that just giving time to listen to what the faculty educator has to say is so important, right? We want to make sure that we hear their perspective, because they could be sharing information that we didn't know before going into the conversation. At the end of the day, I've always found it helpful, and I think Laura would agree as well, is to try to prevent making it personal. You know, I think when emotions get involved, sometimes we may not be on our A game. And it's really important to stick to the facts, as you mentioned before, Ira, and to really stick with what the objective data is. And in this case, the objective data is the feedback and the evaluations that Kate has seen. So really going back and honing in on those to provide specific examples to our faculty educator will help build Kate's case. At the end, I really think that it's really important to create a game plan and make sure that it's something that both faculty advisor and Kate have agreed upon. And then last but not least, we've really found it helpful to always follow up. You know, the other person, the resident or the faculty educator, may not have time to follow up, but like, we're in a position this year, we've had the time to follow up and make sure that we address these concerns.
I love that, some of that, because I feel like there's a component of like getting that psychological safety right, you know, having the conversation, and then the follow-up plan of like what, you know, what worked, what didn't work, what landed, what didn't land. We had a whole other episode around kind of that post-feedback period, actually, that is super crucial, but I think sometimes we don't capitalize on. And I feel like with what you're saying around this type of didactic adjustment, the follow-up is key. And I wonder, kind of, you know, jumping off of that psychological safety to kind of create that and have that conversation, sometimes it might be helpful to know about someone's personality, or at least awareness around personality. Julie and Ashley, thank you so much. I mean, the workshop was incredible. Also, just shout out your use of Kahoot, was it? And yeah. Would Kahoot. Love to hear Kahoot. More. Kahoot, thank you. Would yeah. love to hear more about that, kind of in terms of engaging workshops. But we really, I feel like health professions education, there hasn't been a lot written about or discussed about regarding personality awareness. Can you kind of bring us up to speed about it and really what it is and, you know, how we can apply it maybe for specifically for Kate's case?
Yeah, sure. When we, you know, sort of looked at the topic, we thought of personality awareness as really being attuned to what somebody else's approach to a situation is, right? Or how they typically communicate. And so one half of it is that awareness of how they may, come into the conversation. But then the other half is sort of adapting your own response to that or your own typical communication patterns, given that you now have an understanding of what they work and or how they communicate. So being able to take, change something you may do normally to adapt to their personality in an effort to get the best outcome for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to throw in an example, we were talking earlier, let's say Kate approaches this faculty with a more direct, like, hey, the residents are not able to ask you questions, just very upfront and direct. And the faculty's response is, well, what are you talking about? I give them plenty of time. So that goes back to one, obviously not knowing their side of things, but then she also needs to change how she's going to approach this. So then she needs to start giving the kind of more facts, more details. Well, this is what was said to me, like the past two didactics you did, they didn't get the opportunity. So she really just has to, be active listening to the faculty's response and really be adapting how she goes forward with that.
And I'm curious how you put this actually into practice. In your workshop, you highlighted the Mint HR Smalley Trent personality test,
yes.
Which I took, and you're a target.
I
don't know if you guys did too, but I thought it was a really interesting one. But I can associate with my beaver self.
Yes. I may have been a lion and a little bit of otter, but maybe a lot of otter.
But I'm curious how you actually use this in your work. Has your group actually taken this quiz and shared the results, or you just kind of keep these archetypes in mind and assign them to people? And it sounds like you would need to have a pretty close relationship with someone or know them over time to be able to do that. I'm just interested in how you make that work.
So I actually do this presentation with my residents each year during a noon conference. And most of the times they are just like shouting out, oh, I'm this, I'm that. I always like to kind of gauge it by that. But always in my mind, with every conversation, I'm trying to pick up those little details for each one, like how are they reacting, responding, just things like that. So I really try to just be mindful with any conversation to try to pick up on those details or try to figure out kind of how to best approach them in the future.
I, on the other hand, had never heard of this test until Ashley brought it to me. So, no, I did not have my 167 residents take it and try to remember that. But, yes, I would say that I do, in general, go around and assign sort of a type of personality to each person as I start to meet and get to know them. And as you mentioned, it's something that's really built up over time. And now, the people I've worked with for 3 years, I always say the admin or the faculty that I support and I, we share a mind, I say. I mean, I know everything about her. But clearly we didn't start that way. But I do always think that there are those, sort of personality cues you can pick up on right from the beginning. We talked when prepping for the session about how, you think about being a didactic, right? There's always those people that are sitting in the back, trying to hide. They don't want to raise their hands, right? And they'd be terrified if you called on them. And then there's the people in the front row, right? Raising, they want to answer every question and they just know everything. So there is a bit of that spot on, like you can make those assessments. And it goes, a lot to do with things like their body language and those nonverbal cues that you're, not necessarily immediately thinking of, but you'll realize that you are getting a picture of that person without ever having spoken a word to them.
Mm-hmm. That sounds so amazing. What's the name of the test again? Because I kind of want to take it.
Yeah, it's the Mint Smalley Trent Personality Test.
Okay, Mint Smalley Trent Personality Test. It's so interesting hearing you guys talk about how you observe, like, other personality types and behaviors, because you know, from our approach, it was more about self-reflection. And so, like, one of the common complaints that we hear is, oh my God, I've talked to this same person so many times about the same issue and nothing is changing. I don't know what's going on. And a lot of times it's because you who are initiating the conversation are having a communication problem. It's not the other person who's, you know, failing to receive that message. And so did you guys talk at all about self-reflection and kind of how your personality plays into that dynamic?
Yeah, absolutely. One part of what we discussed in our session was using active listening skills. And within that, we talked about the one that comes to mind for me is, you know, when you're listening to somebody speak, you're not rehearsing. That's the one that I'm the worst about, right? I'm always like, they're talking and now what am I going to say back? What am I going to say back? And I really do. I start to miss what they're saying because I'm so worried about what I need to reply. And so to help, you know, get through that, I'm a person that just has to really do this thinking. And so I have to focus on doing that really active listening and just stopping myself from doing that. But what the advice that we always gave or talked about in our presentation was, it's okay. It's okay to have those initial reactions. You just put them on hold. And then once you get to that conversation, we first said, you know, make sure that you are communicating back what they said to you to make sure you have a clear understanding. And then starting with that, okay, I've heard what you said. I'm going to need some time to digest this and think about it. And from there, you know, say, I'll get back to you in a day or two with my response. And then, you know, go back and do that reflection on what happened.
And the other thing I'll highlight, Julie, while you're thinking about that, is that y'all both in the workshop actually had us do that reflection. So the test is really to, like, enter in kind of what, you know, rings true to you. And so you get this profile and you're like, oh, my God, I'm a lion. And then you're like – and then you're reflecting on what it says the lion's good at and what they're not so good at. And they're like, oh, my God, is this, like, hitting true for me? So it wasn't just, you know, the active listening components was huge because I think not all of us, you know, maybe are aware of those things, but I think even having us take the test and then reflect on the types, you know, and how that works in communication, I think was a huge part around reflection, kind of, and just being self-aware that, like, oh, okay, I might approach this, you know, not personally, but maybe as a lion, and then this other person might approach this as a beaver. So then, like, how do we give feedback or do the feedback conversation with these two personalities, like, interacting? And one thing I was going to say, and you don't have to answer this question or not, but I feel like, Ashley, you having done this with your residents, I think sometimes there is this feeling of, like, this test can't contain me. And I definitely felt that when I was like, I'm not just a lion, like, I'm these other things too. And do you ever get that type of, like, or either of you, do you ever get that type of pushback of, like, this isn't totally me, or, like, I'm not totally that archetype or whatever, you know?
I think I do it to myself, honestly, which is important. What I do love about that test is they give your dominant trait and then that subdominant trait. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of all of the personalities in each of us. Some come out stronger than others. So that's what I love about that test. It's like, you know, it's not saying you are exactly this type.
I also love the dominant and then the subtype mm-hmm. part of that test. Mm-hmm. Because for me, I found my dominant and sub to be opposites mm-hmm. of each other. And it really does just sort of, like, hone into the fact that none of us are the same person at all times, mm. right? Like, we obviously have a personality that is ours, but we are constantly impacted by the environment around us mm. or the happenings in our lives. And learning to adapt, you know, to understand that you are a changing person as well is important to understand that approach when coming to others, because that flexibility in how you enter into something that is can be a difficult conversation. You know, like, if they're having a great day, it's going to be a little bit easier. But if you're approaching somebody that's already had something bad happen that day, like, you have to be able to go in there and pick up on those cues and make, you know, those adaptations as you enter.
And I'm so glad you said that, Julie, because it's really natural for us to handle different types of conflicts differently, right? If you're handling conflict with someone who is considered a friend, you might not be a lion going into it. But if you're handling a conversation with maybe your program director and you want to be a little bit more like firm about your decision, you might have to bring out the lion side of you. And I think that's totally okay and it's natural. And I actually like encourage my co-chiefs and all of us to like find what works best for the communication, for us to have clear communication. So that's really awesome that your residents are having the opportunity to take this test and kind of figure out where they lie.
Yeah, I feel like self-awareness is just a huge part. We all spend so much time focusing on one another, trying to figure each other out, but we also need to focus so much on ourselves. An example that my director always gives is, you know, she's been in conversations where, like, whatever was happening, she has gotten upset, you know, all of a sudden. And she's had to step away. And she's, with some advice that she had given me. And I was like, oh, yeah. You know, it's important to try to, depending on how the conversation's going, if you find yourself getting angry or upset about it, you know, it's important to stop and reflect back on, okay, why? Like, why am I getting upset about that? And more than likely, the other person was not even meaning it to come out that way. It's just, you know, how I was perceiving that. And so it's really a lot of work for ourselves to get to know ourselves, know what, you know, where our weaknesses are and how we can improve upon that.
I think someone once told me kind of the way that they approach conversations that are maybe going to be challenging or maybe going to have some emotion evoke in them is that they have like one eye out, one eye in. And there's this component of like what's happening kind of outside it with the person, like what is the situational awareness about what's going on in their face, what's going on in their body, what are the words that they're saying? But then the one eye in is like, what am I feeling? You know, to your point, Ashley, like what's going on inside? What is the emotion that's coming up? What's the feeling that's coming up? What's my face doing? You know, all the kind of things that we sometimes forget about because we are just hearing those words, or maybe we're really focused on them and not hearing the words. And so I found that kind of approach of, when I am in a potentially challenging conversation, am I focused, am I able to be kind of aware of both things, like the outside world and the inside world a little bit?
And I feel like a lot of that goes into asking questions. Even like as coordinators, we can serve the role of a therapist at times for our residents. And so if they come in upset, you know, I find myself, you know, listening to them. And then once I find a moment, I start asking them questions to kind of let them start reflecting on themselves on, you know, okay, well, why are you feeling the way that you're feeling right now? You know, was it because of this? Is something else going on? You know, so that's just a big part of it.
Yeah, and I think it just goes back to what we were discussing earlier about the preparation before a conversation like this, because you do really need to do your homework. And, you know, whether it's a formal list or outline, the way Laura and Samatha have done, or a more informal process of just, you know, taking that time. I'm literally thinking in my head about the power pose, right? Mm. Like preparing to go into a conversation and just actually like stealing yourself. But I don't like using the term stealing yourself, actually, because that makes it feel like you're going in there like
firm.
Yes,
yeah.
Firm.
Yeah.
But really, it's more just like taking that moment to pause, prepare, and really do that introspective look at what, you know, you're anticipating will come up for yourself, right? Because we don't know what's coming from the other person. So you have to do that work to understand your own biases going in, and also just what you know about your own emotional reactions and how that may play out.
Yeah, so I mean, I love everything you guys just said, you know, Ashley talking about sort of being a therapist as a coordinator, and Ira mentioning kind of like one eye out, one eye in. I really like that metaphor, by the way.
Not me. That was Chantal Young, who was one of our guests in our first season. Yeah.
But, you know, I also think for us, it's important that we, you know, shared with our audience that there are natural tensions that develop when you're having difficult conversations, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a productive and professional dialogue. And so, you know, for us, it was really important to sort of separate what is psychological safety versus what is being, you know, comfortable. And so, because we grow through discomfort to some degree, right? But it's important that you're having a conversation where the other person is participating. So, you know, we were talking about, well, if the other person seems withdrawn or starts making like these sarcastic comments or becomes domineering, that's a time where the safety seems to have broken down, you know, and you may not be having a productive conversation anymore. And I love what you said, Ashley, about misunderstanding intent, because a lot of times we're having a conversation and we mean something positive or productive, constructive for the other person, and they've misunderstood our good intent, and they can end up taking that personally, you know, as sort of an attack on their character. And so that's a really, you know, common way, I think, that safety breaks down. And for us, it was important to come back to a mutual purpose, take a pause and, you know, say, okay, why are they interpreting what I just said the way that they are? What did I mean? And, you know, what's the goal of this conversation? And to sort of hit the pause button.
I love that. I'm glad you brought it back to the psychological safety, because I did want to talk a little bit more about that. And I'm curious if you have other tips about kind of setting up the conversation to start out with a baseline of psychological safety. And I think the act of listening is really important with that. And would love to hear if you have other tips.
Yeah, so I think, you know, sticking with the facts is super important. And I mean, I think for me, my favorite step, and probably the one that I'm the worst at, you know, from the Crucial Conversations book, was making these assumptions. I tend to, you know, just sort of create context for circumstances, and we do it without even thinking about it.
Among friends, Laura, we all do. We all do this. Yeah.
You know, we do it without thinking about it. And so, you know, really stepping back and saying, what do I actually know versus what do I think I know? And it's kind of, you know, when we're in the realm of what do I think I know is when misunderstanding starts to happen. And so getting back to facts, and I think also like physically pausing the dialogue can be really important. You know, if I'm feeling emotional, the other person's feeling emotional, having a chance to sort of process what those emotions mean and see, are we capable of continuing a productive dialogue, or do we need to come back at another time? And that's totally okay.
And I think it's also really important to stress that when the psychological safety of a conversation breaks through, sometimes it may not be anyone's fault. You know, emotions are just high. Everyone is very invested in what they're coming to the meeting with. And if it happens, just as Laura said, taking a pause, because no conversation after the fact will be productive if the psychological safety is not there. So remembering to just take a pause, reflecting again, and going back to the conversation with a new perspective where you can work on rebuilding the safety will be really helpful. I think this past year as chief residents, you know, we've faced some situations where residents have felt like there was mistrust in leadership. And the way that we kind of approached it is self-reflecting on the feedback itself and really trying to separate the emotions from the feedback. And I think like a lot of us, we put a lot of passion into our job, and sometimes we associate feedback with an attack on maybe one's character. But it's helpful to like remind ourselves as that it's not necessarily about you or who you are, but it just might be about the job and the role.
Yeah, and I think, you know, also highlighting among the four of us, there's a huge spectrum of how prone we are to do that. So I would say, you know, unfortunately, I am probably the person who's going to be the most reactive and the most likely to immediately take something personally. And I think, you know, Priya is somebody who's incredibly deliberate and objective. She's got like this engineering mindset where she really wants to analyze everything. I'm very instinctive. And, you know, I think you and Fareed sort of fall somewhere in the middle there. And so it's been a really challenging but, you know, great opportunity for growth for me to be on the receiving end of a lot of feedback that, you know, can be hurtful sometimes. You know, you spend hours and hours working on something to try to do, you know, something great for your residents, and then it's not received well, or they misunderstand, and, you know, it's hard not to take that personally. You know, but separating out, you know, my emotions about the situation. And also, I think for us as chief residents, remembering that we don't have a stake in the game anymore. You know, what we would have liked as residents isn't necessarily what the the current residents want or need. And that can be a little bit tough too, because, you know, we're thinking about, well, I would have thought this is the most fair way to go about it. And then, you know, we plan, you know, something all out with that in mind. And then the residents are like, I don't like that at all. And, you know, so every class is different, and sort of rolling with the punches of how they change and remembering that it's the job itself isn't, you know, personal for us anymore. Like, we're invested because we're passionate about the program, you know, but in terms of the outcome, it's really not going to affect us. And that was sort of an interesting transition.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I'm sure you guys all agree that it is about our residents. It's about advocating for our residents. And so I think, like, we work so hard to make that happen. And communication skills are, you're going to be having communications with your residents on a daily basis. Some go well, some might not go well, but there's always room for growth on both sides.
Totally. And I love how y'all kind of broke it down in terms of the things that can go well and the things that cannot go well and what happens when things don't go well. And would love to hear, you know, if there is, like, for Kate, maybe a sense of mistrust as part of the finale, because we talked about the pilot, talked about the act, and now we're getting to the finale. Kind of what would you advise for Kate? But I also want to open it up to Ashley and Julie if there's anything else besides active listening relative to the psychological safety piece that we haven't mentioned yet that's coming to mind. Because we all wish that we could be like Ashley, where everybody comes to you and feels psychologically safe to just, you know, share everything. But any other things we want to add from that piece?
When we were talking about the psychological safety before, I mean, we really were discussing about how using the act of listening within a conversation is really just about instilling that trust with somebody. And so it's just important to demonstrate in every way that you can through your body language, you're asking questions of somebody else. And and a really important piece to me is the saying it back to them, right? And that gives them that chance to say, yeah, you've got it, or absolutely not. That's not really what I was referring to. And being able to do that is going to get you, you know, build that trust in that relationship and give you the ability to, you know, keep moving forward in a collaborative way instead of making it feel either, you know, such like an attack, a personal attack on something that they did.
No, 100%. That was exactly right. That was exactly right.
And just to add to that, it's very important to continue to build relationships with all these people outside of these moments of these hard conversations that you may have to have, because the more you do that, the easier these conversations are going to be in the future.
And I really like what Samantha said earlier about that when the psychological trust breaks down in a relationship, it isn't necessarily anybody's fault. Because I know personally, I am one to always think it's my fault when I go in. And I do, like, I have never thought of it in that exact like context, that like it really is just, you know, could just be an emotional reaction. And that taking that break really could, you know, help you come back a little more safe, for lack of better, you know. And so I like the idea of reframing, right? And that's something we do, you know, talk about, you know, is making sure that you're reassessing constantly and adapting, right, as you go through this. Because it's always difficult. And if one way doesn't work, clearly you just got to keep working to find the ways that will. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love your point, Julie, but also just checking for understanding. Like, am I making myself clear? Did I understand that person or understand your point? And that person has the opportunity to say, yes, this is exactly what I meant, or no, this is not what I meant. And recognizing that it might be no one's fault that that happened, but checking for kind of the moment of clarity. And I guess maybe turning back to Samantha and Laura, in terms of your finale piece of this conversation, is there anything that we haven't mentioned yet? Especially if, you know, for Kate, maybe there is a breakdown in trust or safety.
I think it's really important to first acknowledge the emotion that she's feeling, right? What she's feeling is real. If she feels like there is a breakdown of trust, then it's really important to acknowledge it and just address it head on. In our experiences this past year, when there's a lack of trust, it's important to pause the conversation and kind of self-reflect as to how you got there. And kind of going on to earlier, it might not be anyone's fault. It could have just been how the conversation was going. The second thing I really want to stress is that it's important to separate the issue from the trust in the person, right? So the issue here is the feedback regarding not having enough time for questions. And so it's not necessarily an attack about anyone's character at all. It's not about the faculty educator and who they are as a person, just reminding everyone that it's just about the feedback, and really going back on that is helpful. If Kate does notice that the tensions are running so high where the conversation is not safe anymore, she should not be continuing in on the conversation, because it's not going to be worthwhile or productive for both parties that are involved. So it's important, as kind of Julie mentioned as well, to take that time to self-reflect and then go back when you're in a better headspace to approach that conversation a little bit safely.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, really focusing on separating the issue from the person is our brains so badly want to make these sweeping generalizations, right? So, you know, if you have a situation like you had a resident had a clinical encounter with an attending and they felt like the medical decision at the end of the day was inappropriate for some reason, it's very easy for them to not only lose trust in that attending's clinical skill, but also in their ability to teach them at all as an educator or give them professional advice, you know, really extrapolate that I had this one bad experience, you know, or this one moment where we didn't totally align, and now I'm thinking that I don't trust you as a person.
Do you mean going up the ladder of inference, Laura?
Yes, I do.
100%.
Yes, I do. You know, and we do it unconsciously. So that's why I think for us, a big portion of our talk was just about being deliberate about what you are saying, what you're doing. And by, you know, the way to do that is sort of control what you're thinking. You're going to feel emotions. It's normal to have unexpected responses. But just taking a moment to figure out why you're having the response that you're having, and trying to get back to the facts as well. You know, and keeping your objectivity can really help mitigate those assumptions and rebuild trust, I think, because we've all had experiences where somebody has disappointed us. And what a shame if we just ended relationships with people based on that one encounter.
I guess coming back to Kate's case holistically and thinking about, you know, both the personality awareness, I think one thing, you know, we didn't ask Kate or this faculty educator to take the, you know, Smalley transpersonality test, though they definitely should before they talk to each other. Okay, let's pretend that Kate is a beaver. And she's talking to a faculty educator who's a lion. And yeah, Kate would like to know from the experts how to
tailor things.
Yeah, to talk to this lion who may or may not be me. You know, see?
Oh, I love that example. So I picture, and Julie, you are a beaver, so correct me if I'm wrong. I picture Kate approaching it with a bunch of data and facts and figures, and the faculty will be like, what? Like, get to the point. I don't have time. No. In a much nicer way.
Yeah. You know, when discussing with a lion, the advice we, you know, give is just be direct, be short, mm-hmm. and, you know, keep it, you know, basic and to the point. They want to do, you know, have the conversation, address it, and be done with it and move on, right? They're a very determined group of people, right? They're just, you know, want to keep going with it. And they need that more direct approach. And when you go in with them and you know, hem-haw, or you give too much information, that's what I'm so guilty of as a beaver. Like they get frustrated and just done with that. So you would want to tailor it that way.
Amazing. And can you think of an example in your work as an administrator where you've used these skills that have really helped you be successful in having a conversation?
I would say yes, for sure. I work with a program. Well, actually, she's no longer program director. She's a vice chair of education, who I think embodies many of these different personalities, but I think where we sort of tend to have our clashes, I find her to be sort of the otter. The otter is sort of the social, outgoing, wants to please, and wants to just do everything and is so fast-paced. And we have those clashes because, as the Beaver, I am very slow paced, and it is incredibly difficult for us sometimes because she wants things and I just can't get it to her. So we really kind of worked out a system of, almost doing like a weekly outline where we go down, you know, we prioritize the tasks, and that gives me my data driven. And then I know what are my data to drive my, workflow for that week and what the most important things are going to be to focus on. It took us time to get to that system. Like, we tried so many different systems first before we like found something that was really working. But by, continuously trying to work at it and figure out that method, we have found something that's working really, really well for us to be able to meet both her goals and my need for extreme minute detail and perfection.
And often call myself at work the speed bump. So if I'm working with whether it be chiefs or program directors or administrators, and they're like very like, yes, let's do this right now, I'm usually the one that, wait a minute, let's stop and think about this for just a second, because my coordinator mind is, oh, well, what does the budget do? Let's look at policies. Let's look at this. Let's get everything in order.
I love that.
And then they usually are like, oh, okay, yeah, let's think about this.
I love that. And I would highlight that y'all have been doing this for a while, and being able to kind of rapidly incorporate these skills, I feel like has shown, it sounds like it's been pretty successful for you.
I think so. And I think one, sort of interesting things when we did this in the room and in general, our observations is that there are almost zero coordinators that are otters.
Interesting.
It is not, we were talking about it, but they just don't fare well in the environment because there is such a need to be so minute and detailed, yeah. Right? We do see lions. We see lions a lot, those that'll go in and take charge. But otters are not very common in this profession.
Interesting.
Well, and I like to say it's because we have got to manage those doctors.
Absolutely. Probably right. Well, Laura and Samatha, do you all feel like maybe you've shared some examples kind of broadly, but that these kind of crucial conversation and communication skills have influenced y'all's experience and successes as a chief this
year? Oh, my God. I feel like as a chief resident, you are constantly giving and receiving feedback. Like, I don't know that there's any way to prepare you for stepping into that role and realizing how continuous the feedback is, whether it's feedback about your resident rotators, feedback about a rotation, feedback about didactics, feedback about, policies that you're rolling out, and you find yourself having to have these conversations both with residents and then also with faculty who may be extremely seasoned faculty, and you're like, hey, I'm brand new at this job. And so having a structured approach and doing the prep work, has been so important for us to help the program evolve without breaking relationships, and help our residents grow from feedback without, hopefully them feeling like things are personal.
And we've really learned how to become adaptable as communicators, because as mentioned earlier in the podcast, everyone is different and everyone's approach to conflict or conversations is different. So I think like the fact that we've been able to kind of like mend towards who we're having the conversation with was a big highlight for me this past year. I think it's also helpful to really understand that communicating between us, we have different personality styles and we've learned from that as well. And there's been so much growth this year professionally for us and hopefully for our residents too.
Yeah. I think, sometimes we even find ourselves like, I think this resident would respond to feedback better from this particular person because of their personality or their relationship. And it's not that the other three are incapable of having that conversation. It's just, how do we set up the situation for success. And so really having that faith in each other and growing and learning how to communicate amongst ourselves has been very enlightening.
You were aware of personalities yes. without even knowing it. Yeah.
Well, and I have to say, I'm really excited for your team to go take the test because at the top of the, you know, conversation, when you started describing each of you, I was literally in my head going lion, otter, beaver. What's the other one?
Retriever.
We also don't have those in the coordinator world.
I'm not going to lie. You're probably right. Like, kind of based on how this has been going, I think I'm a lion, and I think you're the otter, right? Yeah. We'll take the test, though, just to see.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Priya is a beaver. I don't know what a retriever is, but, you know, we'll find out.
Yeah. Well, Samatha and Laura, thank you so much for sharing the Crucial Conversations framework. I think it's really helpful and just sharing all of your reflections and the experiences that you've learned from over the past year, because certainly Chief Year is a huge growth curve and that will continue into faculty or fellowship as well. But wondering if you have some main take-home points for us.
Of course, just to kind of like reiterate clear communication and trying to really work hard to being direct with what you're intention is and what the goal of the conversation is really helpful. You know, during the conversation, make sure you always maintain the psychological safety and also look for like warning signs when that safety has broken down. It's also important in your prep work that you do try to identify any assumptions or biases that you may have going into the conversation so you have time to try to fix it before. And then last but not least, at the end of the conversation, just create a game plan that both of you guys agree upon and just always try to follow up. I think those are some of the key communication skills that have helped us with many conversations.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we say be direct, we don't necessarily mean go in and steamroll the person with feedback, right? Because not everybody responds to that well. But just by being direct, we mean sort of sticking to what's objective, you know, as opposed to throwing in thoughts and opinions and assumptions into the matter, you know, and be very clear about what your goal is, because a lot of times, you know, you'll find that the goal is ultimately the same. You just have different approaches and different understandings about the situation. So like in Kate's case, for example, you know, her goal is to get her residents quality education that they enjoy and that they retain. I'm sure the faculty member has a similar objective for their presentations, right? Like, they don't want their presentations to be terrible. They want the residents to want to come to their talks. I mean, it's terrible giving a lecture to a dead room, right? Like, so, you know, you probably have more common ground than you think that you do. And so just by being really explicit about what you hope to accomplish can be really helpful.
That's perfect. Julie, Ashley, any take-home points y'all want to share for the audience?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of the biggest take-home points is just to make sure that you are putting in the work to understand the perspective of those you're having these difficult conversations with, and also putting that effort into learning your styles and how you can adapt and respond in order to help ensure that psychological safety in a conversation.
Yeah, and just to echo kind of what you're just saying, just be mindful of people's cultures, their backgrounds, and just understand that no one fits perfectly in a little personality box. And so just challenging yourself to work on that in every conversation, even the lightest of conversations. Just try to keep that in the back of your mind and work on that, and it can go a long ways.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing, and we're very excited to share it with our listeners.
Woo!
Yes! Well, Ira, that was amazing to get to sit down with so many people. This, I think, was our biggest interview group.
Yes,
very possibly. Much so. But yeah, what take-homes do you have?
Oh my gosh, Molly, so many. I think I liked how Samatha and Laura broke down kind of the pilot, the act, and the finale, and kind of getting ready for that type of conversation and just the power of really that preparation and just making sure that you're actually clear about what your objective is, you know, is potentially, or in Kate's case or in this case specifically, that it may not be just that one didactic. It might be kind of overall all of the kind of didactics, and how can we improve that for Kate, and still knowing that we're separating that from the identity. This is not like a reflection on Kate as an educator. I think they did a really good job making sure we keep that in mind. And that's something that I'm going to take with me the next time I have to have a feedback conversation around that. What about you, Molly? What did you take away?
I loved that too. I think what I'm going to take home is Ashley and Julie's highlighting of the importance of active listening in these difficult conversations or serious conversations, and kind of being aware of our own emotions and not trying to jump ahead and make conclusions and not trying to focus on what you're trying to say next, but really listening in the moment, and how that can be so important and powerful for letting us make connections and move forward and get to the points that we're trying to get to together.
I agree with you. I thought you were going to say that you're going to take away that, you know, when we have conversations, the animals that we embody, that we're going to focus on those. But I will say,
I will focus on your otter self. Yes. No, your lion self.
Lion otter.
Lion otter.
But I will say, you know, to highlight that, this was my first time hearing about this, and just reminding, I think Julie and Ashley both said, like, you are not just this personality box, and awareness of those tendencies is really important.
Absolutely. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. And thanks to all of our team who help us behind the scenes with writing our show notes and CME. Thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. And thanks to the team at Podface for editing and production support. Until next time, I'm Dr. Molly Hoeglein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I'm Dr. Ira Krasnovskaya. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.